Media Mind, a new podcast from the TRT World Research Center, unpacks some of the most popular yet misunderstood news events of the month, examining them and connecting them to the defining political, social, and intellectual order of the 21st century. In each episode, academics, journalists, activists, and opinion leaders will unravel political narratives surrounding issues ranging from global politics and media controversies to criminal justice and corporate crime.
Hello, everyone. First of all, I have the great pleasure and honor and delight to host Mrs. Shafag Mehrlareva from ADA University from Azerbaijan. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Tarek, thank you very much. It is always a pleasure to get connected with colleagues at TRT World. I say that as a media professor here, as a program director for communication and digital media program at ADA University in Baku. We have launched this program only 3 years ago. We have been following not just global politics, but regional and particularly local as well as a university. And we love to share our opinion on issues that you are going to cover today. So I'm happy to answer your questions.
Well, that's awesome. And I know you have covered unfortunate and tragic episodes from the first war of Karabakh between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And you have been sending reports about some massacres there. So tell us a little bit and help us piece a little bit.
When it comes to Karabakh issue, it is always personal first because my family roots are from Karabakh. And we have been internally displaced from the city of Agdam for the past 30 years until fairly recently when the city was liberated and returned under the Azerbaijani control. And in fact, this day when this podcast is happening, we have another group of internally displaced people who, with extreme happiness, are returning to their native homes in the city of Fizuli. The reintegration process, return process of internally displaced people have already started. So yes, I do have a personal perspective on this conflict, being from there and also as a journalist. I have covered Karabakh conflict or had an opportunity to look at it from the United States for about 15 years as the special correspondent for Azerbaijani news agency. After return back to Azerbaijan in 2010s, I've joined ADA University, where I have switched to sort of analyzing this issue from a scholarly perspective. So I feel lucky that I have sort of a 360-degree view on that, which I think gives me quite an objective position to understand and mostly see the solutions. Because I think that when we are on the journalistic side, we mostly care about today, what is happening right now. And as you know, and your colleagues know, in media, we all live by headlines and deadlines. So no matter what big tragedy happens, usually it has, a lifespan of 3 to 5 days, depending on the, scale of the tragedy. But this conflict has been reality of not just Azerbaijan, but for the entire Caucasus and generally, Eurasian space. And as we go along in this conversation, I hope we can talk about how the area and region affected by the new situation now. But since it affects a wider area, media hasn't covered it because the hot events happening during the conflict, they occasionally happen, once in many years, but we have lived with this reality and still do. So hopefully I can share some of those insights with you today.
Absolutely. And this is why I am really, truly delighted for our audience to have you with us because of this 360 degrees perspective that you have. You know, the intersection between media journalism and also being a media scholar is also very important because it gives all the ingredients to understand how media frames the situations, how this conflict has been conveyed and portrayed for international audiences. And I'm also thankful that you are sharing also some of your personal perspectives, being from that region and also knowing some of the grievances and the plights that the internally displaced people are facing throughout their, their ordeal and their lives afterwards. So my first question would be, you know, you have witnessed like from the beginning till now, like the first conflict happened in the 90s, and now, you know, there is like some more developments. But I would like to know more about like how do you see the trajectory, you know, like the beginning until now, like if you can, in a nutshell, just tell us, being from then, being a journalist and also a media scholar.
I think that if we take the conflict from the beginning, one of the mistakes that usually media does, and generally the outsider, it views Karabakh conflict, this particular episode, as something that have started only at the end of 1980s. And in order to understand this conflict, we have to look a little before, because similar events between Armenians and Azerbaijanis living in Caucasus region happened several times. In 1905, in 1918, and when you look at those years, you realize that the stakeholders don't change, the sides don't change, and the, you know, the interests don't change, because Azerbaijan is located in a very complex geopolitical area with interests of many formerly empires, currently superpowers, countries involved. So every time when there is a clash of interests, you would see smaller states, smaller nations starting, you know, bickering with each other. So I think that this particular episode of Karabakh conflict that hopefully has been finalized recently also is part of the same historic current, if I may say so. But if we take this last episode at the beginning of, at the end of 1980s, when events started, you know, happening in back then autonomous Nagorno-Karabakh, that has been again conveniently placed within Azerbaijan, borders has been drawn in a way by Moscow, where every time clashes happen, Moscow can jump in and become a mediator and have an influence on both sides. So that is also is reoccurring event, reoccurring sample. But at the end of 1980s, when the Soviet Union started dismantling, Azerbaijan was that particular sort of fire, erupting fire, that expedited the entire political processes across the Soviet Union. And one after another, you would see in the area of the Soviet, former Soviet Union, this kind of territorial claims, ethnic conflicts happening. Of course, it was very unexpected for Azerbaijan, because after the last historic episode at the beginning of 20th century, we've had about 80 years of peaceful existence under the Soviet Union. Of course, there were some events happening under, you know, behind the scenes in Moscow as well. But put that aside, if we only talk about population, it was a peaceful existence. So to have your neighbor who you have lived together, shared your life together, you know, happy moments, grievances together, turn against you was a complete surprise. The event started by ethnically cleansing Azerbaijanis living in the Republic of Armenia. So the first flow of refugees to Azerbaijan came at the end of 1980s. And I remember I was in high school back then, and some of my neighbors in the capital city of Baku, where I grew up, were ethnic Armenians. So the first solution was doing a swap of apartments, where Azerbaijanis, ethnic Azerbaijanis coming from Armenia would exchange their apartments in Armenia for with Baku Armenians, so to speak. But these were only a small group of lucky ones, because most of the refugees who didn't know anyone, who didn't have those connections, they didn't end up in that particular situation. The second wave of already internally displaced people started when Armenian side started actively occupying one region after another, until 1994, when former President Heydar Aliyev came to power in Azerbaijan, and he realized that the only way to stop this madness, so to speak, would be to declare a ceasefire, so Azerbaijan could have an opportunity to breathe and to understand where to move forward. So since that moment on, for more than two decades, Azerbaijan has been trying to solve problems. the conflict diplomatically, peacefully, despite being, you know, a victim to the aggressor side, despite having lost close to 20% of its territories and having a million people of refugees and IDPs. But unfortunately, it hasn't gone well. The conflict has never been taken seriously enough for international community to implement the decisions that it adopted on UN Security Council floor. For those who are following the conflict, you may know that in the beginning of 1990s, there were 4 UN Security Council resolutions, probably, you know, the most effective international tool that we have in terms of international law, demanding immediate and unconditional withdrawal of Armenian forces from the occupied Azerbaijani territories, but it never happened. So after trying for decades, Azerbaijan decided to launch what we called peace enforcement operations. The world saw it as a war. We saw it as liberating our own territories and staying within our own internationally recognized territory borders.
Absolutely. I think these are very good reminders, and it's a good summary of, you know, I give you a big kudos for summarizing such a complex, situation and history in few minutes. Absolutely. I think, this pattern of having conflicts in which there are UN resolution, because Azerbaijan was unfortunately a victim of all these transgressions coming from Armenia. And Azerbaijan was, as you said, caught by surprise. It had a lot of refugees, a lot of IDPs, a lot of problems, a lot of its territories taken by, like 20% of the territories taken by the Armenian side, illegally against all declaration and statements of, you know, international organizations, including the UN. There were 4, like, as you said, resolutions. So how I know that this war in 2020, in September 2020, that was launched, was, I know Azerbaijan tried everything in its possibility to find peace, but it was like the conflict was frozen for 30 years. Like all these mediators, the so-called mediators, like there is this group of Minsk. Can you tell us a little bit about this logic of freezing a conflict, and how does it impact country like a nation like Azerbaijan?
Right. Well, thank you. That's a great question. And I think that here, as again, a media professor, I need to remind our listeners about the importance of terminology. Probably one of the reasons why it never got into the agenda, international agenda, because we kept referring to it as a frozen conflict. For us, it was simmering. It was never frozen because casualties continued, only because it did not turn into a large scale military hostilities like it happened in 2020, in the fall 2020. It never was frozen to us because every decision that the Republic of Azerbaijan made in terms of internal politics, in terms of foreign politics, had to take the consequences of Armenian aggression into account. And in that case, it is not frozen, because frozen means that you put it aside and you deal with it whenever, you know, there is an appropriate time. So that was not the case. It was simmering continuously. But you're right that there was, from 1992 and onward, an international effort to mediate the solution of the conflict. But those efforts, they ended up making few breakthroughs in terms of negotiation process, but they never really brought to any substantial, you know, success in terms of moving us forward to the solution. And I think that as the global situation in the world changed and other security issues, including in our own area, came forward, I think that this conflict has been being pushed further to the background, and Azerbaijan felt that it cannot last like this. But more than anything, to me personally, what happened in 2020, and you probably know that what have been started in 2020 was finished only, you know, a few weeks ago by a 24-hour yes. local anti-terror operation yes. where Azerbaijan literally restored its sovereignty on every inch of its territory. Because after 44 days in fall 2020, we did not have that opportunity yet. Once again, with the goodwill of Azerbaijan, we decided to stop active military stage because we didn't want to have any more losses from both sides. So we decided to, again, continue with active negotiations. But since this didn't yield any results, we, sort of finished what we started through military means. And frankly,
Let me just interject here and say that, in both cases, like even before the launch of the war in fall 2020 and the anti-terrorist operation that was done a month ago, there were like a lot of provocations from the Armenian side, and especially the so-called secessionist self-declared republic in Karabakh, which every time they call it Artsakh from the Armenian side, which every time, they have this kind of provocations, political provocations, military provocations. So can you tell us about those provocations? Because they also explain how Azerbaijan took this decision and went to war to retrieve its legitimate due, what is legitimate by international law, but still choosing the path of war because there was no other way to do anything else.
That's a very legitimate question by itself, because when we talk about provocations, we usually think in terms of military. Someone necessarily needs to die or something needs to get exploded to create that kind of a reaction. And I still remember leading to the events of fall 2020, the event that completely changed the Azerbaijani approach and particularly had Azerbaijani population public rebel against the current situation was Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan dancing in Karabakh, celebrating, which was Azerbaijan felt it was a mockery straight to its face. And all of these so-called elections that has been conducted by self-declared, Nagorno-Karabakh Republic, all the attempts to try to legitimize the occupation were drop by drop those events that were considered as provocations by the Azerbaijani side. So it doesn't have to be necessarily a bullet, or a bomb that could cause this reaction. But all of these actions from the Armenian side was an indication to Azerbaijan that Armenia is moving away from the negotiation table every day. It gets itself distant. So that was an indication to us that diplomatic ways will not work like that. Because if you want to solve the issue peacefully, you are trying to come closer in your perspectives, stance toward the other side, rather than distancing yourself. So I think that Armenia getting more and more distance with those kind of provocations, what caused Azerbaijan to take the matters at their own hands, so to speak.
Absolutely. And, in the absence of serious mediators, in a situation where the international community doesn't care about the problem, in a situation where there are multiple provocations, including provocations that are touching the sovereignty, the integrity of territory of Azerbaijan, of course, there are no other ways. And as the famous strategist Karl von Clausewitz said, war is the continuation of politics by other means. So this was the only way forward. So tell me, we have now this admirable victory. It's, a lot of observers didn't see it coming. Like in one day almost, or in like a couple of days lately, there was an anti-terrorist operation and the whole this self-declared republic like collapsed. Like, tell us about this victory and what is the impact of this victory on the geopolitical dynamics in the region?
I think that, particularly when we're speaking about the reaction of international community, the Karabakh conflict case was a very vivid case and probably one of the first ones where, the doctrine of President Erdogan that he outlined in 2013 when he said that the world is bigger than five, finally manifested itself. It was on the statements, but I think that the victory of Azerbaijan in Karabakh literally turned into a case that would support that particular doctrine. After the ignorance of this conflict by international community for such a long time, and simply, very superficial work done by mediators, Azerbaijan, by its victory, proved that once you change your own strengths, once you ally, you know, with your neighbors for the common good, international big players don't even matter in that case. So world is indeed bigger than five. So to me, I think that the changed reality was one of those. Of course, many political realities has been discussed in media by experts, including reconciliation, which brings to more harmonious, potentially more harmonious societies in Caucasus, and opening of transportation and communication roads, etc. But what I would like to especially mention, something that we don't see mentioned in media a lot, and I think that it deserves more attention, the latest events, which is with Azerbaijan's victory in Karabakh, the so-called Nagorno-Karabakh Republic has disappeared from the list of gray zones in the bigger area. The gray zones of the big Middle East, where there was no strong statehood, where there was no political stability, by Azerbaijan restoring its control over its formerly occupied areas, that gray zone has literally been gone. And you know from the reports of many international organizations that for the past 30 years, those zones have been used to carry out drug trafficking on the route from Afghanistan, Iran, Armenia, and further on to Europe, with a purpose to support materially and ideologically proxy groups that caused instability in you know, other countries. Now, when I speak about that, a quote by former President Roosevelt comes to mind, who said that when the peace in the world is broken somewhere, the peace everywhere around the world in danger. So when it comes to a very interconnected world today, that actually goes beyond than just a statement. Once Azerbaijan restored its control in these territories, this entire system of criminal business, which was very carefully built and crafted for close to 30 years with its multi-billion dollar revenues, collapsed. And I think that what caused a wider irritation in the region was not even the fact that the conflict has come to an end, but that source of sponsorship, so to speak, to those proxy groups has evaporated. It would be good to remind that once you cut off the sponsorship to the groups, the group that is being sponsored doesn't have to check with the sponsoring side anymore. It already causes enough irritation and lack of coordination between them to go on and sort of make autonomous actions, right? So I think that in the coming months and years, we're going to see a lot of echoing of the loss of this gray zone across the bigger Middle East.
And I'm glad that you are bringing this, you know, this topic, because a lot of people have, you know, especially some groups in the West, they have kind of romanticized this entity, this self-declared republic, so-called Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh, as they mentioned. So it's romanticized. It's viewed as, you know, some entity with like values and moral high ground. But the reality, as you are, you know, rightly pointing, it was like a narco state. This is like a criminal organization that was doing all kind of trafficking, from arms and weapons trafficking to drugs, and everything is, the flow is going to Europe, and it's financing all kind of shadowy, you know, groups and whatnot. So this is very important, which brings me to the subject of the media coverage. I mean, you hinted at some aspects of this media coverage, but how can you tell us more about the media coverage of Nagorno-Karabakh? Because I know, somebody who observed, that it was for the most part appalling.
Well, let me put completely aside my personal take on it and the fact being from Azerbaijan and just speaking as, you know, a media scholar. I think that here, in terms of media framing of the problem, we have seen a very interesting approach. Generally, in a media world, storytelling as a genre becomes more and more popular. And let's very quickly remind ourselves why. Because media's job is to deliver objective information. Most of the time, objective truth is very complex. It's not black and white. It is very difficult to comprehend. So the storytelling genre has been sort of emerging with a serious journalism just to make sure that more and more wider public understands the issue and gets involved, encouraged to participate in a democratic governance. But I think that for the past few decades, particularly since the emergence of social media, storytelling in serious journalism have been getting more and more attention and taking more space. And if we remind ourselves this holy triangle of Aristotle's persuasion, right, where you need to have ethos, logos, and pathos, storytelling falls under pathos. We use it to create an emotional connection with our followers, with our readers. But the problem here is that lately, when it comes to Karabakh conflict, what we see in media coverage is that an exclusive usage of pathos, storytelling, and a relatively little logos, not to mention not using the right ethos, meaning experts who can provide objective view, explaining what we're doing right now, how this affects, you know, geopolitical realities in the region, or what to take from it in terms of international law, or the future of conducting warfare, right? What we see these days, and I mean, I observe it here when our foreign colleagues come to Azerbaijan, they're looking for a connection. They are very interested in human stories, which I understand, because those are the stories that can get you clicks, that is very easy to comprehend, that is easy to sell, so to speak. But by doing that, as media, we are doing a disservice to our audience, because our main mission is to help put things in perspective. And if we are choosing just storytelling without looking into serious facts, without analyzing, and giving simply a screenshot of the happening event, then it means that we are not doing our job right. So framing is very, very important. And another point that I want to make about storytelling, if we look at these past 30 decades, when you look at the narrative of Armenia on the conflict and narrative of Azerbaijan, it is a very interesting approach based on the starting points. Azerbaijan speaks with facts. When we talk about the conflict, the narrative that we use usually is based on international law, as we have mentioned, UN Security Council resolutions, documents, etc. We refer to agreements, international agreements, etc. So we speak logos. When you speak with facts, you usually are not very passionate or work too hard to prove your point to others, because to you, it is a knowledge and you expect other sides to accept it for what it is. Facts are not debatable. When it comes to the Armenian side, their stories and their approach is based on faith, meaning that the story of the greater Armenia that we have heard many times, the story that, you know, these lands belonged historically to Armenia and many formerly Armenian territories has been grabbed by different states, including Georgia, Turkey, etc. So when your starting point is faith rather than fact, you feel more passionate about persuading others in believing your story. So I think that the difference between informational attitude, narrative building between these two sides come from this beginning point. Here, we're talking facts versus faith.
Well, that's a really good explanation. I really thank you for elaborating. So if for our audience, what would be some examples, like if you want to give us some of the most erroneous narratives? Now, I understand the general framing that sometimes they go into this historic accounts, this mythical approaches to greater Armenia that existed long before in history. But is there any like narratives that you want to touch in, or some frames that are, you know, disturbing for you as a media scholar and for, you know, other people to know about?
I think that we don't even have to look too far for it. Just to look at the coverage of the past months, what has been happening in Karabakh since the last 24-hour operation by Azerbaijan has been over. The overwhelming Western media perspective that we see is that there is an ethnic cleansing going on in these territories. There is a huge outflow of Armenian population. There are threats. There is a starvation. I mean, I was very, very surprised to see those kind of stories from a reputable media outlets like BBC, like New York Times. And then we have organizations like UN coming into the region and producing reports saying that all of those claims are erroneous. So I don't see our Western media colleagues covering or giving as much space to these kind of reports by international organizations clarifying the situation compared to the stories, the atrocities and ethnic cleansing claims that they have done before. Coming back to my point that this is not a story that sells because UN reports are boring. You know, you need to really work hard to make them attractive. But a claim, a picture that, you know, has been taken. And even if we go with the human stories, I don't want to exclude humanitarian side from this, because at the end of the day, this entire conflict is all about people, and the desire of the Azerbaijani side is also build peaceful relations with its neighbor. But if we're talking about Armenian population in Azerbaijan choosing to leave, and we share tons of pictures about their plight, about the way they were stuck in traffic, about the difficulty that they, you know, have finding places to live, etc., at least it would be a contribution to the objectivity to show the plight of the other side, what happened 30 years ago. And unfortunately, ethnic Azerbaijanis were not given the same opportunity to leave their native lands with the same comfort and with the same choice. Most of them were killed. They were ethnically cleansed. So that's one thing probably to consider for our colleagues in international media, to try to be objective, because as I said, the story may sell for a day or two, but the effect it has on the realities in the region remains, unfortunately, antagonizing sides against each other rather than contributing to the peaceful solution.
So yes, I hear you loud and clear, and I believe you know what you said is you know, you touched on a very important point. But how you know, these instances of bias and one-sidedness in Western media, is it due to other factors, like for example the might of the Armenian lobbies, like in Washington or in France or elsewhere? Do you think that's one of the reasons, or there are other reasons besides the need to sell a story? Because there's too much. Like for 30 years, no matter what Azerbaijan does good, is never reported. If there is something that's happening that is, you know, unfortunate or even a lie, would get like reporting and coverage and massive reporting on this. So what can you tell us?
I think that it is a mixture of reasons, as you rightfully pointed out. You know, getting ready for our meeting today, I've just reviewed some of the Western media stories, and not just from today. As you said, I followed it for, you know, 20 years now. And I think that there are three framings that we have witnessed over the duration of the conflict. One was that it was an interreligious conflict. They would always put the sides against each other, that this is a Muslim Azerbaijan and Christian Armenia. And framing the issue like that would usually result in, you know, international community adopting the appropriate frame. Then you would see, for example, countries like France, United States, with very strong Armenian lobby under their influence, taking an active position, but unfortunately not an objective position. So that was one framing. The second framing that we had was that this is a territorial conflict, right? Territorial conflict. In that case, we get usually superpowers with an immediate interest in the region getting involved when you frame the story like that. The third was that this is an international law breach. In that particular case, the countries with similar disease, so to speak, similar problems would get involved in the conflict. So framing is very, very important. And dependent on how different media outlets framed it, then you would look at it differently. But thankfully, Azerbaijan always had enough arguments to counter those framings. For example, when we have been, or the entire world has been, preached the story of Karabakh being a disagreement between a Muslim Azerbaijan and Christian Armenia, you would immediately remind that, you know, Armenia and Iran, in this case, were very close military allies, and primary reason was that particular gray zone that we've talked about at the beginning of our conversation. So if this is really interreligious conflict, then how come Iran, which is the largest Shia Muslim country in the world, instead of defending and supporting second, you know, Shia Muslim country in the world, takes the side of Christian Armenia? So it is the job of journalists to do their trade, their profession justice, and analyze considering facts and not simply storytelling aspect of it.
Well, I mean, that was very admirable of you, I mean, outlining this different types of framings. That it's very informative. Thank you for sharing those with us. So I want to know from you, like, what's your vision from now on? You know, like, what is Azerbaijan trying to do? I know that there have been calls for putting like some sort of agreement. So what's up in the air? What do you think is? I know it's difficult to forecast the future, but just, you know, what's your impression?
It is indeed difficult to forecast the future, because in this case, unfortunately, all the events are happening. We are at the mercy of goodwill of the Armenian side, if I may say that, because no matter what kind of plans we have, it takes two to tango, right? So it cannot be just overwhelmingly Azerbaijani side. Even if we succeeded with our peace enforcement operations, still to build a prosperous, peaceful Caucasus with neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, working, collaborating, and living peacefully side by side, it takes two to get to that purpose. But long story short, what Azerbaijan wants to do, it wants to create same kind of relationship with Armenia that we have currently with Georgia, which is of collaborative nature, which is directed at creating a prosperous region where the living standards of population in every country would be lifted. You may have heard that Azerbaijan is the largest taxpayer into the Georgian economy, because right now all of the major export routes go through the Georgian territory. And before those routes have been built, there was actually a similar offer to the Armenian side, because if we would have built it through Armenian territory, it would have actually cost less, it would get to the European markets faster. But this conflict has always been a very difficult, biggest impediment on that. So I hope that with the latest events, Armenian people, Armenian public will choose, just like Azerbaijan's offering a peaceful future where all three states of the Caucasus will live peacefully. I always tell to my students in the classroom that we have quite a few examples around the world where formerly neighbors who were at war, they have finally buried the hatchet, so to speak, and they chose peace over war. So I can only pray that we are at that time of history when all three Caucasus countries will decide to build their own peaceful place where each nation will prosper together.
Well, on these words of wisdom, I'm afraid we have reached the end of our session. You have given us a lot to unpack. Thank you very much. These were very, very good insights. I hope we will have other sessions down the line to get even more opinions of yours and insights of yours. So thank you very much for being with us today. And best of luck with your students and academic career. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to see colleagues at TRT World. Thank you.
Well, that was all for this Media Mind episode brought to you by the TRT World Research Center. This session was produced by researcher Shema Nourion. I hope you enjoyed it. Please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and Spotify. kindly leave us a review and rating. Thank you very much.